Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Brian Reisman. Welcome to the 25th episode of Side Jams, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Guitarist Brad Gillis has sold millions of albums and toured the world many times with Night Ranger, the hard-rocking quintet who you know from such hits as Don't Tell Me You Love Me, Sister Christian, and the Golden Globe-nominated Secret of My Success. The group is still active 4 decades later, and their most recent album, Don't Let Up, shows just as much fire as their early recordings. During the downtime of the pandemic, Brad has finished up work on his third solo album. It's his first in 20 years, and he remains active composing music for the likes of CBS Sports, ESPN, and various video game, TV, and film clients. He even placed a flamenco track on The Price is Right. It's a lucrative gig that he's had for 2 decades now, and you can delve into that more at his site, musicalmansion.com. Now, when he's not composing, touring, or just jamming with friends, Brad loves to collect vintage guitars. After all these years, he's got it down to a science. For this episode of Side Jams, we talked about how he first got the collecting bug, how he procures items for sale, his process in determining their condition and their worth, and tips for new collectors. We also chatted a bit about riding his Harley along with other physical activities he loves. Brad spoke to me via Skype from his home in Lafayette, California. It was our first time connecting, and we had a blast.
So this podcasting was all about people's hobbies and their passions. What's interesting is that your passion actually, it does extend into music with collecting vintage guitars. But I was thinking too, I mean, I'm a comic book collector, I'm a movie collector. Like sometimes when you collect things, it's not always just for exactly what it is. I imagine when you look at certain guitars, you're not just thinking about how it sounds, right? You're like, hey, I've got, this is a cool looking guitar.
Yeah, not only that too. But, you know, my advantage has always been, Brian, you know, being on the road and, you know, always having like a day off or during the day before we do sound check to be able to bop around that city and
right.
And hit up music stores and pawn shops and fun stuff like that. And I even get to the point where I go on Craigslist and I see if there's anything cool in town. If I see something cool, I invite somebody to the show. Next thing I know, by the end of the show, I'm giving them cash and getting a new guitar to send home. So, you know, basically I do a lot of TV music. So trying to get all those different sounds for whatever they're looking for. You know, you need all these different type of guitars, and I'm collecting old, you know, old Marshalls, stuff like that. But I really got into the old Fender Blackface amps from the 60s, and, yeah. You know, I got a 59 Bassman, which is like the holy grail of Fender amps. And, man, I just started going crazy in this stuff. And the great thing about my profession is that they're write-offs. I can write this stuff off. So, you know, at the end of the year, when I start doing my taxes, my tax guy's going, all right, how much did you spend on guitars this year? I go, oh, shoot. He goes, you better, you know, get up to this amount. You know, we need the write-off. So I get to go buy another guitar or two. So that's always kind of fun.
That's hilarious. When did this obsession with collecting guitars start? And then, you know, when did it get out of control?
Well, I wish it would have started back in the 80s, because when we were touring back then, all these guitars that are worth buku bucks right now were actually in the realm of real money of what they're worth, right? And we were out with Cheap Trick. Rick Nielsen invited us over for dinner one night, took us downstairs to his guitar collection, and I saw all these old Strats and colored 60s Strats and the Holy Grails, those 59 Les Paul Standards and all these great guitars. And I went, wow, this is great. I should have got the bug then, but I didn't. I was blown away by what he had, but, you know, I didn't put my money into it. But about 20 years ago, around 2000, a friend I'd met online that had a He had a guitar that he had in the paper 20 years ago. Okay. There was no Craigslist then. And I thought, wow, this would be a great guitar to have. And I called the guy up, and he lived pretty close on the San Francisco Bay Area. He was down in San Jose. He goes, oh, Brad Gillis, oh, Night Ranger, oh, man, I know. He goes, come on out to my house, man. I'll show you all my collection. I thought, okay. So I went over there on a Saturday, hung out with the guy, greatest guy in the world. We got to be best friends.
Cool.
Still are. He had this major collection. He goes, you know, I'm recording a record. And I said, you know, my buddy has a studio in Hayward, which is about in between him and me, like a half hour from me, half hour from him, yeah. Him coming up from San Jose. And I said, you know, hang out, work with my buddy Jim Hawthorne. He's great. So he hooked up with Jim and did his record there. And he says, man, I want to have you come down and play some guest solos. I said, okay. And he goes, what if I give you a couple of vintage guitars? And I'm like, okay.
So give you a couple of vintage guitars?
Oh, I played all over his record. He gave me a 56 Les Paul Junior mint condition.
Wow.
And a 52 ES-175. Unbelievable guitars. And that's what got the bug going. All of a sudden, I started, you know, getting the fever. So, you know, he'd help me find things, and I'd find things, and we'd go on the road, and I'd find more things. And so now I'm up to about 120 guitars and 40 amps, but I can only play one at a time.
You don't try to fuse any of them like Rick Nielsen, just like, you know, six of your guitars together into one big Frankenstein.
Oh yeah, I got a picture of me holding that Hamer guitar with the five necks on it, and he's holding my red Strat, and he's got shaving cream on. It's like right after sound check, and he's shaving, and
wow.
And he, you know, I said, dude, I want to take a picture of your guitar. He goes, well, give me yours. So I got this great shot. This thing is like 50 pounds. I can't see how he played it, but great classic guitar made by Hamer. And we were endorsed by Hamer for a while, and they made me a nice little double neck. But I never wanted a guitar with five necks. It's just too much overkill. Plus, it's already been done.
Well, you know, being a collector myself, like, you have to have a fairly large storage area in your home to take care of all this stuff. So what do you do?
Well, I actually had a room dedicated to guitars. I took them all out of their cases. Of course, you got to realize I got about 15 on the road. And we have an A rig in Nashville and a B rig down in Phoenix, Arizona, that holds all the guitars that we play live and backups and acoustics and stuff like that. So okay. The rest of them at home, I ended up taking them all out of cases and put my cases up in the rafters of my house,
right,
and set them up and got all these different, you know, the stands that hold five, six guitars, you know. I ended up getting a bunch of little stands. I had them all set up in this closet in this room and all over this room. And, you know, it was great because my studio's here too when I record. And I just pop in that back room and grab the guitar of my choice and set up an amplifier. And I'm getting the sound that I need for whatever project I'm doing at the time. So, you know, there's been a lot of fires around here, Brian.
Yeah.
Right now, especially, I got them from the north, south, and east of me, but luckily they're not too close to me. But about a year ago, wow, I was just when the other fires were happening, I just flew into San Francisco Airport after doing a show on a Saturday night. So Sunday morning, I'm flying in, and I'm driving home. They said, I live in a town called Lafayette, California.
Right.
And they said on the radio, we have a fire in Lafayette. No, Lafayette's a little bedroom town. It's a really nice, beautiful town. And I tell you, when I heard this fire was close to my house, I was 40 minutes away from home.
Oh.
And, you know, your heart's pounding. You're thinking the worst. All my guitars are at home. Long story short, I was able to get home. The wind was blowing 40 miles an hour. I could see the fire over the hill. I could see the helicopter going by, dropping the water and everything. Freaking out if it came over the hill, I'd be screwed. So I started
throwing
all my guitars in my Rover. And I called my buddy, who's a commander at the California Highway Patrol.
Okay.
And I said, Christopher, I'm driving over. Christopher, there's a fire in my town. I go, can you call Cal Fire and find out exactly what's going on? So he made that call, called me back. He says, yeah, Brad, it's right over the hill from you. And he goes, get home soon. And, you know, he goes, don't do anything stupid. Don't get killed. You know, don't get burned up. So anyway, yeah. I finally got home thinking they would drive me away from my house. But I was lucky able to get up to my road, and I started loading all these guitars up. And I'm loading these guitars up, and this car pulls up, and I go, all these fires going on. Who is this? And it was my commander. Commander Christopher came to help me out.
Oh,
so
wow.
He came and filled his car up. We loaded everything up. The wind's blowing. You know, you can see the fire overhead. He's hung out with me till they finally got a handle on the fire. Luckily, it only burned 2.5 acres. It burnt down the Lafayette Tennis Club and a couple houses. But that next day on Monday, I went, this is too close to home, man. So I went right over the freeway to this brand new cement storage place and rented a storage and drug all my guitars down there and put them in there. I only keep a couple at home now. Yeah, man. Scariness.
And well, I see a whole band set up behind you. So is this also rehearsal space for the band? Or is it rehearsal space for you?
You know, we've had the guys here before jamming. We're thinking about getting them out, but the situation's too to delegate right now to get anybody over for anything going on at 3-4 days at a time. So we're holding off that. But I do music for TV and sports and ESPN and all that stuff. So I got all the equipment here to be able to get whatever sound I want. But I have what I call big time karaoke over here.
Okay.
I get my musician. This is before all the COVID. Last couple of years, I got a full PA system here. I got a drum set, got all these amps.
Congas.
Yeah, I got congas. I get my buddies over here, and we'd slam whatever songs he wanted, and we'd jam along to them. That's why I call it big-time karaoke, because everybody's, you know, singing out of a PA system. I got the music blasting, playing drums, I'm playing guitar. Sometimes I'm playing bass when I got a guitar player here. It was just a lot of fun, man. And I'm kind of in the woods here, so I can make a lot of noise. But that's my setup here, and basically my whole brains and recording computer and everything's upstairs in my house, and it feeds down to downstairs here. So when I do music for like ESPN or Fox Sports or whatever I'm into at that, whoever hires me for what, I have a drummer that sits on this kit behind me, the talkback system, and I'm upstairs talking back to him, and I'm playing him the track with the click track, and he's playing drums along to it, and I'm recording him, recording downstairs, feeding upstairs to get what he's playing. So that's what's great, Brian, is I'm able to work at home, man. I got a lot going on here.
Yeah, same here.
And I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm able to work from home.
When you find a new guitar, how does a new guitar seduce you? How does it speak to you when you've been collecting these things? What draws you to something?
Well, I've been into this for a long time. I mean, I knew I was pretty deep into guitars, you know, when I started out back in the 80s and stuff, you know, using different guitars and amps to record records with and such, even though I might use the same guitars live.
Yeah.
I just got into it. But, you know, then I got a bunch of good friends now that are seriously collect. And these guys are purveyors of 50 Strats and you know, the big money guitars. So I started seeking and trying to find these old 50 Strats and just old vintage guitars that have their own sound, their different vibe. But, you know, I always like things that are all original. And I don't care if they're dirtied up because I clean them up. I make them, polish them up real nice. And I, you know, I clean them up. You take them apart, make sure they're all original. Before I take them apart before I even buy them. You know, I'm sitting there at the guy's house.
Really?
Like, dude, I got to take this apart to make sure nobody routed it out for a humbucking, you know?
How do they react to that?
Well, I mean, if you want the sale, you know, I got to, you know, they know what I'm doing. They know I'm a collector. So, you know, I pull it apart real nice and document it and take pictures. And once I know it's right, I bring it home. Then I really clean it up. And then I put up new strings and set it up to height of the strings and everything. Then I intonate it and plug it in. Boom, there you go. But I started really getting into these old Strats, these 50s and 60s Strats. I got about a dozen of them. I tell you, man, the sound of a 50s original Strat, there's no comparison. They just got this twang. I got this, you know, the feel and the sound. It cannot be replaced, you know. So, you know, then I go, well, I don't have one of these. Oh, let me try to find one of these. And then I used to go do the eBay thing for a while.
Yeah.
And now Reverb's out. I kind of do the Reverb thing. And I have a bunch of friends around the country and around the Bay Area that look for me. They go, hey, Brad, the friend of mine is father passed and he's got a 59 Strat. Are you interested? I said, oh, yes, I am.
Oh, they know how to get
you. So, they know I'm a collector and I'm good for my cash. So that works out well.
And what's the most unusual looking guitar you've picked up?
Well, I have these, the Gibson Moderns are called.
Okay.
They're kind of shaped, kind of weirdly shaped, kind of like in between a Flying V and a Gibson Explorer.
Hmm.
And if you know those guitars, it's weirdly shaped. No one really uses them live, but they came out years ago. And this is funny. And someone will say, yeah, I go, yeah, I'm looking for one of those Moderns. And they go, you mean that Flintstone looking guitar? And I go, no, that Jetsons looking guitar. they're natural wood. They got a crazy shape to it. So I got a few of those. Those are kind of wild.
Yeah.
You know, there's different guitars that, you know, that they made back in the day that just have weird shapes and stuff. I never got into those cheaper guitars and Italian guitars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I go for the big boys, the Fenders, Martins, Gibsons, and, you know, anything else that's kind of close to that kind of quality of guitar. But, I started when I was 8 years old. The Beatles came out, and then I wanted to be a guitar player. And it came around my birthday, and my dad's like, what do you want for your birthday? He goes, I want an electric guitar and an amplifier. My dad's like a Navy guy, you know, got a Navy dad, you know. Yeah, right. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
my mother, who played piano and sang, she goes, my dad, you know, Jesse, you know, look into it. You know, my, you know, maybe if he takes lessons, you know, if he's into it. You know, so my father said, you know, all right, for your birthday, I'll buy you an electric guitar and amp if you promise to take lessons. I said, oh, sure. Are you kidding me? I want to learn, right?
Yeah.
So he took me down and bought me a K Vanguard 2 electric guitar and a K amplifier. And I played that thing, took lessons, and had a blast just playing that thing. And you take a lessons, this old man that was teaching me, of course, I'm probably older than him now. it was like I was learning, like, you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb and all these, you know, these old standards. I didn't want to learn that. I wanted to rock. So my brother, being 7 years older than me, had a friend his age and came over. He was a guitar player. Said, Brad, you're doing pretty good in guitar. He goes, Start listening to the radio, man. Listen to all these songs. With the chords you know, you'll start to figure out what chords go to what song. You'll find out the one, the main chord, maybe usually when the chorus comes in.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and there's, you know, there's a 1-4-5, which goes to the E and the A and the B. He's given these basics, which I kind of already knew. But he said, implement that, you know, your those thoughts, the radio. Just listen to the radio. Man, that's all I did was listen to the radio, man. And everything that came out, you know, a Gloria and I'm Henry the Eighth. I mean, all these crazy songs on AM radio back then.
Yeah.
I started picking them up and I started getting it down. I said, screw taking lessons. You know, I'm doing better off by just listening to the radio. I'm learning faster, right? So around 1969, 1970, I was 12, 13. Mm-hmm. My brother had all the latest, greatest records, man. Led Zeppelin 1, Santana, all these great records. And he set up a little box. He was into electronics. Made this little preamplifier for me.
Uh-huh.
I plugged my guitar into it. He took it out of his record player and went into that box. And with another out, that went to headphones. So he'd go out every night. And I'd go into his room. And I'd play all these great records and just listen to them. And try to learn how to play. We're talking your Big Brother and the Holding Company. Blue Cheer. You know, Santana or Braxis. You know, all these. The Doors. And I was just playing. And I learned how to pick the stuff up. And it really improved my playing a lot by doing that, you know. And then I thought, well, I got to start getting into lead guitar. That was another story.
Now, is there ever been a guitar that you wanted that you couldn't have, that you saw somewhere, like somebody outbid you, or it was there 1 minute and when you went back later on, it disappeared?
Well, a couple of people outbid me. The thing is, you know, that's fine because I'll just look for another one. But, you know, the guitars I always wanted are the big boys, which are that Gibson Les Paul Standards from 1959 and 1960. Those things are worth $250,000 up.
Whoa.
And I just can't get into that right now. That kind of money.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of friends of mine have them, but they bought them years ago and paid 70, 80 grand for them, you know, but that's just too much for me. But, you know, I got no problem sinking a good 20, 30 grand into a nice 50 Strat, because that's the holy grail of Fenders, and you'll never lose money, you know.
So when you had all this stuff in your house, what did your friends and family think about all this?
Oh, everyone likes to come over. I have no neighbors, so I don't really bug my neighbors.
Yeah.
I'm lucky to have this spread out house where I'm at, and I can make noise. I make a noise every day because I'm doing this TV music and stuff. But like I said, we get over and we do these jams and high-end karaoke and stuff like that. And it's a blast, but that's all I do. All I do is music and have a blast doing it.
What advice would you give to somebody who's, you know, starting to collect guitars? Like, what have you learned over the years about the business transactions and what you're looking for and the kinds of people you deal with?
Make sure it's original, first of all. Second of all, you know, a lot of these guitars have been refinished.
Okay.
And if they're refinished in the 60s or 70s, it's hard to tell if it's really original or not. So there's ways to find out. I won't get on all the details, but, you know, just make sure it's all original. And, you know, look in the book and look at eBay and Reverb and see what they're going for and try to get a deal on this stuff. You know, a lot of guitars on eBay and Reverb, they set this high standard price on there. Like, oh, I sold the same guitar on eBay and it's worth this. It's like, I'm sorry, you sell it on eBay, but it hasn't sold. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The same with comic books. I know some people have something at, like, you know, or even DVDs. Like, I met some people like, oh, this DVD is worth $80. Then you see someone sold it for 20, but the person who sold it for 80, it's still sitting there.
Right.
eBay is kind of a weird realm. I assume you buy everything in person. I can't imagine you've probably bought much online. Or have you? I don't know.
No, the only reason I buy something online, if it's through a friend of mine that's in that town that collects and he's buying for me and he knows what's going on. I really haven't been you know, a couple things, you know, I buy something and then, and maybe a pickup was an original or a couple knobs weren't original, but I got so much crap here that I could just put the right pickup in it or the right knobs or whatever. But, you know, here's some advice. If you're going to buy something, don't go on eBay on, you know, what's for sale. Go on whatever you're looking at and look up sold items of that guitar you're looking for. Then you could see what it really sold for. Then you know what it's worth. So that's some good advice right there.
What's the strangest place you've ever found a guitar that you purchased?
Oh, gosh, the strangest. Oh, I don't know.
Or unusual.
Well, I had to actually get right home from gigging with Night Ranger to find out this guitar was for sale about 100 miles from me, kind of up in the mountains. And it was wintertime. And I called him up and I said, I'm on my way. I started going up there and it was snowing and I got lost. And this guitar was in a private gated community. And I drove, I couldn't get a hold of the people. I had no service on my cell phone.
Okay.
And luckily they knew I was coming and they were driving around trying to find me and they find me. But that's not really a weird situation. I don't know.
It was unusual. Yeah. I mean, it's like that.
I found them and I got a beautiful. And the thing was, here's a great story about the guitar I bought. My buddy calls me and says, yeah, this lady that lives a couple doors down, her husband just died about a year ago. And he has this old Stratocaster, a 57 Stratocaster. Are you interested?
Wow.
I said, of course, you know. And I said, what's the story on it? And he goes, well, he got it for his birthday. He was 18. His 18th birthday in 1957, learned how to play, started a band, started playing clubs around that Sacramento, California area where I bought it from.
Yep.
Met his future wife. They started dating. They got married.
Wow.
And she gave him the old me or the band.
Oh.
So he quit the band and stuck that guitar under his bed and it was there for 40 or 50 years. And that's that guitar I bought. Wow. Isn't that crazy?
Have you ever bought a guitar just for the way it looked?
Oh, yeah.
Goes to what a great example of that. What was something that really struck you? Like, I just got to have it. This is awesome.
Well, you know, there's a Gibson ES 335s, man. They just got this own look. They're great. They're very popular guitars. I was down at this guitar shop in Nashville, Gruen's Guitars, and I ended up buying one down there because I thought it was cool. Ended up bringing it home and playing it and going, wow, what a great sound.
Yeah.
I started collecting all this fat body electric Gibson ES 175s, and they got a brown burst and the sunburst, and I ended up buying a few of those just because they just look great, and somebody was selling one, and they have their own sound, but they're just beautiful guitars. And these guitars that I buy, they're 8 to 10 condition. I don't buy anything that's beat up.
Okay.
Definitely don't buy anything that's been refinished or look like it's been messed with. I got a great collection of all this stuff. And then I got, you know, a bunch of crazy little guitars, these little half-scale guitars that look like a Gibson Explorer that I put a Floyd Rose on, and you tune it up to an A instead of an E, and it's got its own thing. But, yeah, you know, I buy crazy things too. But mainly the big boys for collecting purposes and trying to get that sound.
I notice most of the amps behind you are Marshalls, it seems like.
Yeah, I got Marshalls.
Actually, I got Mesa Boogie.
I got Boogies. I got Hi-Watts. I got my Fenders. I got a whole Gibson Les Paul amp. I got the first Gibson started putting out guitars in 1952.
Yeah.
And the first guitars they put out were gold tops.
Okay.
Gibson gold tops. It looked like a Les Paul, but they're gold tops. I got a few of them. And the latest one I got was January, and it's an absolutely mint 1952 gold top Les Paul, no serial number. This is before they put serial numbers on the guitars. How cool is that?
Oh.
Now, then also I have another 52 that isn't as good shape, no serial number. Then I have a 53 where they started putting serial numbers on it. And I swear, those things have got to be worth some big money someday. Imagine the very first guitars that Les Paul himself put out that have no serial numbers, you know? I mean, that's crazy stuff.
Now, it makes me think, too, have you ever been in a deal and you walked away from it because you realized the person was shady and that something wasn't right?
Yeah, a couple times. Or things that, you know, didn't look right. Or it looked like a refin.
A refin.
And, you know, a refin, I mean, they refinished the paint. That cuts the value in half or more. And there's little things you could tell when it's been a lot of it's the smell. A lot of it's that smell, man. You smell. If it doesn't smell like a grandma's furniture, then it ain't right.
Really? See, now I'm learning everything. I'm a drummer, so if I start playing guitar now, I've got all these different things to go by. And I was just watching Wayne's World again because I was preparing for this Bill and Ted movie story after writing. I know, like, you know, Wayne's ideal guitar, I think, is like an early 60s white Stratocaster that's sitting, even though it looks completely brand new.
In that glass case. Yeah, of course. That's a great movie.
Is there a guitar like that for you? Is there something that
I already have. I got a couple of those already.
Is there a dream guitar, like something that is your holy grail?
Oh, well, my holy grails are, you know, this 52 mint gold top I just told you about. I have a 1968 Fender Telecaster Pink Paisley. They old hippie days, 68 and 69, they did the Telecasters and they put this film on it.
Yeah.
And this film was either like pink paisley or blue floral film, and then they put the clear coat over that. Well, I have both of those, and the pink paisley I have is absolutely mint. You know, then I have some absolutely gorgeous Martins, you know, D28 Brazilian rosewood Martins from the early 60s.
Wow.
Beautiful. They sound absolutely fantastic. I got about 20 Martins in my collection. So those are kind of the holy grails. I got so many, and they all mean something to me because I've found them in very cool, eclectic places, mm-hmm. and I've set them up myself and dialed them in, and I played them on different songs with either Night Range or my solo stuff or TV music. So, you know, they all have special meanings to where I've implied them on whatever song I'm doing.
Well, that's the whole thing with collecting, is you actually can get sentimental about certain things. Like, I have a certain CD I got at a certain point in college, or, like, there's this part of my early 20s that this happened. And so people who don't collect things in the same way probably don't understand that there are these emotions that you can attach to things. Sometimes you have to let it go because your collection can get so huge, you know.
Right. Well, you know, my main guitar has always been my 62 Fender Stratocaster, the red one I play.
Yeah.
That's a weird story there, is because when I was playing in a band called Rubicon with Jack Blades in the late 70s, we had one hit on the radio, and we played that Cal Jam 2 back March 18th, 1978, the biggest day of my rock life.
Yeah.
250,000 people at Ontario Motor Speedway down in L.A. with Aerosmith and Ted Nugent, Hart, Dave Mason, Santana, and we were the only unknown band on there. You know, the right after we got done with that, I was playing my Black Les Paul at the time, which I still have. Right after we'd gotten done with that, I was hanging out at home, and a friend of my brother's came over. He goes, "Oh, man, dude, you played the Cal Jam 2. How cool is that? I got this guitar. I sanded it down." This is 1978. And he goes, "It's a 1962 Stratocaster. All the box, sanded down, everything, the body, the neck, everything. But the original pickups, everything else is there." Uh-huh. And he hands me this box. He goes, "Hey, you want this?" I went, "Yeah, hey, thanks. I could build it up and do my own thing to it, right?" And you know, when you're that age, whatever, I was only 19, 20 years old.
Yeah.
You know, you're still fiddling with guitars and painting them and putting stickers on them and doing all this crazy stuff to them. So when he gave me the guitar, I thought, well, I'll start fixing it up. I had this Datsun 240Z that was custom painted back then with this orange red Emron paint. And I had an extra gallon. I sold the car and had the extra paint. So I thought, you know what? I'm gonna paint this guitar with this Emron paint.
Huh.
And my brother goes, "Hey, man, take it down to our buddy's shop that paints cars in Oakland. You know, he'll probably do it for free." And I called the guy up. Says, "Yeah, bring it down." In front of my brother, he did it for free. And he hung it on a coat hanger where they spray the cars.
Yeah.
And he sprayed it with the gray primer, actually car gray primer. Then sprayed the orange red Emron paint on it and did a clear coat on it. Guitar body done. The neck sanded down. I took it to this guy named Mr. Kamamoto in Oakland, California, a Japanese guy that redid necks and fret jobs and everything. He painted it black for me, got the original Fender sticker on it, put that on it. Then I put a 22nd fret on it. I don't know, those Fender guitars, they only have 21 frets. By missing that 22nd fret, you could take the very top note and bend it up to a high E. I don't want to get too technical, but I added that extra fret because everybody has them now. So now I got a red guitar, black neck, unusual already, 22nd fret. And then who comes out in 78? Van Halen.
Yeah.
What's he playing? An original Floyd Rose. What's that? Those are the big, huge, solid tremolo systems that you mount on your guitars. They have to be custom mount and routed to fit.
Yep.
And then at the end of the nut that goes to the headstock where your tuners are, there's a, they call it a Floyd Rose nut that they have to dig into your neck to mount this clamp. And the whole idea of it all is once you tune it up, stretch the strings, and you clamp it down, you go crazy on the tremolo and it doesn't go out of tune. So that was, and I love that idea because I was playing some old Strats back then. Yeah. I couldn't keep them in tune. And that's, I thought, how can I get one of these? I found out Don Weir's Music City in San Francisco. Someone said, hey, man, they got one. They only have one. So I called him up. I go, what's the deal? He goes, well, you know, we got the third one. Eddie got the first one. Neil Sean from Journey got the second one. And we have the third one. And I said, how much is it? And they said something stupid, like $600-$700. It's a lot of money back then. I didn't have the money, but I have to have it. So I had a white Les Paul that I never played. I took it down there and I said, I'll trade this for that Floyd Rose. And they're like, okay, sure. You know, they're better at the deal. But my friend thought it was, they couldn't believe I was trading this Les Paul for this new piece of metal, you know, Floyd Rose tremolo system. Anyway, it defined my style, man. I got that thing. I started going crazy on it. When Eddie was doing the harmonic dive bombs, I started doing harmonics and bringing them up and shaking it. These bridges are floating, which means you could go up and down to make your go up and down. So when you do a tremolo on it, it's going under and over the note. Instead of tremolos that are flat against the body, you could only go down. So that on its own was a major revelation for me to start doing that stuff. Then I just started fiddling around with different ideas, banging my guitar one day. I heard it go, burr, burr. What's that? It was the tremolo bar shaking because it was floating. It was shaking and it made the sound. So I started implementing that into my style. So if you listen to the very last note of my solo in the Night Ranger song, Don't Tell Me You Love Me, you'll hear me go, what? You'll hear me go.
Yeah.
Those are all things I came up with fiddling around with that Floyd I got, you know. Then I just started getting a little crazier on the Floyd and coming up with other ideas, but it defined my style, Brian.
Beyond guitar collecting, is there anything else that you do? Like, is there anything you do to relax, something different that's outside of music?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got a beautiful fat boy Harley that I go for rides, and that really clears everything out. And
really?
You know, yeah. I've been riding all my life. Started out with a Honda 90. My dad was a pilot. You know, he had brought me over a Honda 90 from Japan. Then I got a Honda 100. Then I moved up to a Yamaha 250 TT Thumper, they called it. Then I ended up getting myself a Suzuki 750. Oh, and that thing, the motor was too big for the bike. And I got a little too crazy on that, and I pulled a wheelie once, and my hand fell off. And this is right after releasing Night Ranger's first record.
Oh, wow.
And I crashed on it. Luckily, I didn't hurt myself too bad, but I thought, you know what? I can't ride anymore. So I gave it up, and I thought, you know, I'll get a Harley. So about 10 years ago, I got a 100-year anniversary, and then I traded and ended up getting this Fat Boy Low. Actually, I bought it on the road.
Really?
North Carolina, yeah. I was looking at some custom bike shop and went down there, and we were touring with Rick Springfield and the Romantics.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to the bike shop and saw this bike I loved. And, you know, he wanted a certain amount for it. And I said, hey, is your wife like Rick Springfield? And he calls her up and she's all excited. I could hear her on the phone. Oh, my God, I'm going to get him backstage. Right. So I got him backstage for the show. He got him and his wife meet Rick. And the next day I went back to his shop. I go, how much now for that bike? And he cut me a great deal because I took care of his wife. Got him backstage passes.
You're a smart man. So like some people surf that helps them clear their head. Is being on the road, like on the blacktop, that help clear your head?
Yeah. You know, sitting in front of a bus on the road, that's always great, man. Talk to the bus driver and seeing that road in front of you. That's so funny you say surf because I used to windsurf here in the San Francisco Bay for many, many years, man.
Really?
And I had that stuff down. No, I've always been pretty physical and I played Little League and was into water sports a lot. But windsurfing was great for me. But, you know, I got a little older, kind of gave that up. I had jet skis for a while and stuff, but kind of tamed down. I work out on the road. I love to swim. Whenever I'm on the road, I hit that hotel pool. I'm swimming once, sometimes twice a day to blow it out before I do sound check and do that show that night.
Nice.
Just wakes me up and blows out any liqueurs that I drank the night before. So you get a system on the road. When you do it, I've done over 3,000 shows live. So after a while, you kind of get it down, you know, you kind of get your routine down, I should say.
So when you're riding a Harley, I mean, you're obviously aware of the risks. Like, I have a friend who's close in age. So, like, you know, his wife isn't thrilled, I think, with him having a motorcycle.
Yeah, Harley, it's a whole different ballgame, man. First of all, I don't go on the freeway. I refuse to go on the freeway.
Okay.
When I go with the rides with my friends, I kind of live in a woodsy area. Got all these great back roads and the mountains and stuff. And we just tool around, and usually three or four of us, and we keep our distance. And we're all pro riders, whatever. Good riders. I'm a pro, but we all get out there and just, you know, enjoy nice Sundays on the road, driving around and stuff. But I never ride in the rain. I got great gear, the leathers that are, you know, they use with they have the knee guards and of course the side guards and everything.
Yeah.
But you take it easy on a Harley, man. That's the whole thing, man. You know, it's not racing, not like racing around on a Japanese bike. You know, it's like, because you get a bike like that, you want to race around.
Well, yeah, because I know some riders will squeeze through cars in traffic, which drives me crazy. You know.
Oh, that drives me crazy. Oh no, I will not do that, and I don't ride on the freeway, so that doesn't even apply to me. I see these guys, I go, you know, then also, you know, watch the news every morning. Motorcycle crash on 101. No. Motorcycle crash on highway. It's like, okay, these guys are definitely going in between traffic, and someone pulled over, didn't see them. I've almost hit two guys on bikes trying to go by me, but, you know,
wow.
I'm cool.
Is there any sort of activity you're interested in doing or something you'd like, some sort of other pursuit you're interested in that you'd like to do at some point later on?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, being on the road so much, you know, we do things on the road, try to keep us busy on nights off. If there's some type of cool thing going on in that town, we'll hit it up. And though, you know, I like to jam with different bands. That's one thing I love to do, since I learned by ear and I knew all the, I had a club bands when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I love to go into a town with a night off before. We usually get in the night before when we're heading back east, and I'll go in and, you know, jam with a local band at a club. That's always a fun thing to do, because you never know what you're going to get, what guitar they're going to give you to play, but you just kind of get in there and work it out. And now they got everybody filming you. It's like,
yeah, I know.
Okay, maybe I should be playing this guitar through this amp. You know, it's like, I'm really struggling trying to play here, but, you know, it's all in fun. It's all in fun. I have a fun time jamming.
Quick question. Last question. I want to ask some motorcycle running. If someone's interested in motorcycles, but they don't know that much about it, what advice would you give them? And how do you determine if it's really the right fit for you? Because it's not always the safest kind of riding, obviously. It's different than being in a car.
Yeah, man. I don't know. I don't know about telling anybody that's in their 30s or 40s to start riding a motorcycle if they've never rode before. That's kind of a scary thought. You know, usually all the friends I know that are riding rode when they're kids like me and grew up riding, and you know the ins and outs of bikes and how to ride and how to, you know, be a defensive driver, I should say. But anybody that's going to try to find a bike, you know, actually find a bike if you put both your feet down on each side. First of all, you know, don't buy a bike that's too tall for you if you're a short person. Find a bike that fits you. Don't buy a bike that's too heavy for you. It'll fall over on you. That's another one. And, you know, go take bike lessons. You know, there's classes on weekends you could take to, I don't know about now, but, you know, learn how to ride and be a defensive rider. But, it's such a blast to ride. It's I love it. You know, like I said, I don't ride on the freeway. I just got all these beautiful backwoods trails, not trails. It's, you know, I'm definitely on streets,
oh, sure,
roads,
sure, yeah.
Backwoods. You know, you don't take a Harley on dirt, but, you know, it's just, you know, it's just one of my little things to clear my head, you know, but playing music clears my head, you know. I'm by myself doing it, and I do it at my own pace, and no one's yanking my chain, and there's nothing better than doing a job where there's, you don't have a boss looking over at you. Thank my lucky stars to be able to do that, Brian.
That wraps up this latest episode of Side Jams. Please join me for the next installment, which will feature Amaranth singer Elise Vid. The tunes used in this episode are from Fox and the Law, and I licensed them through AudioSocket. As always, thank you very much for listening.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.